Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson. To my mind, my guest today easily fits in the national treasure category as a whistleblower, because I know of no one in his field who has fought as long and hard and well to protect all of us from dangerous psychiatric and other drugs than he. Dr. Peter Breggin is one of the most experienced psychiatric experts in the world. He's been called, quote, the conscience of psychiatry, unquote, for his efforts to reform the mental health field, which include promoting caring psychotherapeutic approaches and opposing the escalating overuse of psychiatric medications, oppressive diagnosing and drugging of children, and I'd add, drugging of members of the military. He's also exposed and opposed the false biological theories behind these medications, referred to as SSRIs or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Dr. Breggin has written way too many books and articles to mention here. He's also been qualified innumerable times to testify in malpractice cases against psychiatrists and doctors in many other specialties. His testimony has involved every class of psychiatric drug, including antidepressants, benzodiazepine tranquilizers, sleeping aids, antipsychotic drugs, and stimulants for children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. He's done hundreds of invited scientific presentations on psychopharmacology, shock treatment, psychosurgery, psychotherapy, and legal issues. In 2010, he was the featured lead-off presenter before the U.S. House of Representatives Veterans Affairs Committee for hearings on risks associated with prescribing psychiatric drugs to the military and veterans, which gets to the reason why I wanted to bring Dr. Breggin on today. This show was partially inspired by my son, a recently retired Marine Corps officer who, after bringing all his men home safe and sound from Afghanistan, has since lost three of them to suicide, one as recently as a few months ago. Everyone knows there's a suicide epidemic in the military, and today, Dr. Breggin and I will be talking about whether or not massively prescribing antidepressants are a contributing factor to this epidemic and what can be done about it. And of course, no conversation about the dangers and abuse of psychiatric drugs can be had without also talking about the effects of rampant prescribing of these drugs to another vulnerable group among us, children. So let's get started. Welcome, Dr. Breggin.
Lovely, lovely introduction. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
So it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the drugs themselves first. Could you talk about, just briefly, the scientific basis upon which they were developed and when you first started realizing there was a problem?
Well, I knew there was a problem all along because I got started as a college freshman at Harvard when I went out to a state mental hospital as a volunteer and ended up spending half my time there, I think. And at first, we just started cleaning up the wards and helping people, get to the commissary or whatever else they needed. And it became really clear to me that everything that was being done to the patients was just to numb them, just to subdue them. The shock treatment, the lobotomies, I saw lobotomy patients. And at the time, the Thorazine, chlorpromazine, was coming in. And anybody could tell that somebody who was on a drug like Thorazine was being made ill. That people would they have a shuffle, it's Parkinsonism, they develop a flat expression on their faces, they get numb, they get docile. It was also pretty clear to me that, at least in the state hospital, the aim of psychiatric interventions were to shut the patients up and to shut the patients down. So I saw it right away because I had untrained eyes. I wasn't defending some sort of professional turf. I was a college kid. And I ended up getting very involved in the program, and we eventually showed that we could help kids, not kids, we kids could help adults get out of the hospital by just spending some time with them and talking to them. And eventually it became a formal program, and it became rather well-known around the country and was written up. But the odd thing is about psychiatry, it's not a science at all. It's more like a political phenomena, social control phenomena. And so over the years that went by, eventually the program was no longer feasible within even a state mental hospital, because the whole idea was that you couldn't talk to mental patients. You couldn't talk to people, especially if they had, quote, schizophrenia or something like that, or bipolar disorder, you know, or severe depression. You had to drug them. And so psychiatry has just gone in the direction of treating everybody in the community as if they were in a state mental hospital. You come in, you get a drug, and at least in this case, you go home, presumably. The more I looked at the drugs, the more astonished I was. I remember, and by the way, I didn't get any of this in medical school. In medical school, the whole theme was the drugs treat illnesses, and I would bring up my ideas about what I already saw in medical school, and the psychiatrist would get really angry at me. I think I was saved by the dean, who's gone now, who really thought I was on the right track, or God knows what the psychiatrist might have done to me as a budding critic in med school. But
wow.
I think that the most straightforward way to say it is that all psychoactive substances are neurotoxic. Whether you're drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana or having a cigarette or taking a psychiatric drug, its effect comes from some dysfunction you're creating in the brain. They don't fix anything. And that doesn't mean it can't feel pleasant. It can't, you know, space you out in a way you like, or relieve some tension, or put you to sleep more easily. But those effects are always short-lived, because eventually you get into a very unstable place where your brain is fighting the neurotoxic effect. So the antidepressant initially may flatten you, but then your brain fights back, and you get a manic episode. Now, some drugs are so strong that they just flatten you, and the brain can't fight back very well, and that's probably true for most of the antipsychotic drugs, Seroquel, Abilify, Invega, Risperdal, Cybrexa. They're so toxic to the dopamine nerves, they so suppress a basic, very important part of the brain called the basal ganglia, that they'll keep you flat forever, really. But the brain still fights back, and then you get abnormal movements, you get psychosis from the brain fighting back against the suppression. So it just became clearer and clearer to me it just wasn't the right thing to do. And I knew from college that I could talk with people who were so disturbed in the state hospital that they might be just, you know, slumped on the floor to begin with, and that people responded to other people. Patients responded to other people, people who were interested in them, people who cared about them, people who presented to them a human being who was a college student and whom they wanted to rise to the level of, instead of the aides who were you know, they just are not very, as a group, very likable people. They weren't very competent people. Nor were the psychiatrists. They weren't likable. They weren't competent. So over the years, I've devoted myself to explaining what even the most disturbed people need. In fact, they need more than the rest of us. That is, they need somebody who will build a trusting relationship with them and help them dare come back to reality, help them dare care again and get engaged again. Go ahead. I've been talking a long time.
It's interesting. I mean, you're saying this and you're fighting a tide of, I mean, the SSRI drugs are, they're it. They're the primary treatment right now for, you know,
everything.
Yeah.
Even for the things they cause, like mania, or they'll give them for anything. Go ahead.
Well, but so, I mean, when you, for example, when you went and, what is it, 10 years ago, when you went and spoke to the House of Representatives Veterans Affairs Committee on the risks associated with these psychiatric drugs, what was the response to that?
Well, it's interesting. In that case, the House of Representatives chairman, the chairperson for the Veterans Affairs Committee, he loved my work. And he had, I didn't know it till I got there, but I was the opening expert to testify. You know, they'll often put one person first and then the others follow. And it was quite a dramatic event because I got half an hour. I was prepared for 2 minutes, but I got half an hour. And I talked for that time, and then the American Psychiatric Association got 10 minutes, and the VA got 10 minutes, and so on. So it would look like a triumph. It was a big event. The press didn't cover it at all.
Why do you think that's so? Why do you think the press is not interested in your line of, you know, in what you have to say about these drugs and... Their effects and a better way to treat people?
Well, I think there are many reasons, and probably we don't even understand some of them because it's a total blackout on criticism of the pharmaceutical industry, period. And it's not just the psychiatric drugs. You know, right now we've got a very, very good drug to treat COVID-19, which is hydroxychloroquine. It's cheap. Right. It's inexpensive. It's been around for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. There's very, very few deaths. It's actually, you know, I'm an expert on what's the matter with the drugs. And it was clear when I began reading it, I was astounded that it's one of the safest drugs ever been made. It's over the counter in some places. And we have a complete shutdown on that in the media because it's against the interests of the pharmaceutical empire. They don't want a cheap, inexpensive drug that will actually help prevent viral diseases including COVID-19. And they don't want a drug that's cheap. They don't want a drug that will not only prevent but will treat in the early stages. No drugs treat when the person's very, very sick. And they go ahead, the pharmaceutical industry goes ahead and invents horrible studies giving lethal doses to the patients. And then the press covers it to show how bad the drug was without ever checking what the size of the doses were. So you have this gigantic kind of thing going on between the media, the politicians. The pharmaceutical industry is the driving force. It's so big. It's so wealthy. So that's one thing. Another, very directly, is I used to get much more media up until the 1990s. I was on Larry King Live, which was the biggest talk show, many times. I was on Oprah many times, which is the, you know, a huge daytime show even back then, and so on. Now it's rare for me to get onto the major media, and I think one turning point was when the pharmaceutical industry convinced the Congress with money and influence and power and threats or whatever they do. To allow for direct-to-consumer advertising. Once that was accomplished, and a part of me would say, well, you know, people should be able to advertise. I believe in freedom. But once it was accomplished, then there was no more criticism. It became like cigarettes were for so many years. When the industry was advertising on CBS and other places, they would never cover the cancer issues. And the psychiatric issues have not been covered since then, except for an occasional little blip. And they sure as heck aren't going to let me on one of these major media. Except occasionally, surprisingly to some of your listeners, I'm sure, the more conservative media. But even like on Fox. But even that has kind of gone the way because of the power of these huge industries.
It's crazy. What you're describing to me sounds like, it sounds like a mafia defending its interests that are actually deadly to the public, and our own legislators and, you know, representatives in the government just simply have overlooked this. I mean, aren't the courts, I would think that the courts would be packed with cases of people suing these drug companies for the adverse effects of these drugs on their loved ones.
Well, we had, I was actually, you know, back in the 1990s, I was the medical expert for all the Prozac suits, all the suits against the drug company. They had dozens of lawyers and over 150 suits. And I was the scientific expert for all of them. So I went inside the company. I got to see all the fraud. I mean, the development and marketing of Prozac was full of fraud. And I got to, you know, interview FDA and read and study. And, you know, I became, the expert in the world on the fraud associated with the Prozac and then with all the SSRIs, because they all behave very similarly. And what the company did was, there was a very good older lawyer who was appointed the head of the consortium of attorneys. So I'm working with the head of the consortium of attorneys. He died. After his death, a fellow named Smith became the head of the consortium. He had four or five suits of his own. And Smith arranged a secret fraud with Eli Lilly and fixed the first trial.
Oh, my God.
And my wife, Ginger, figured that out long before I did. I had already gotten a lot of material. I'd been researching on my own, but Smith cut me off entirely from anything further. Never met with me, tried to put me on the stand without talking to me, which is really, if you know anything about the law, that's bizarre. Don't put your expert up without talking to them first. It was clearly a fixed thing. And if you read the transcript, I'm asking my own questions and answering them. What had happened is they had paid off Smith, the lawyer, and his plaintiffs ahead of time. The judge thought they did it in the middle of the trial, but see, from my experience, I knew they'd done it way early. They were way set up. And even so, we nearly had a hung jury. A 9-3 vote would have hung the jury, and they got a 10-2, and that gave Eli Lilly a victory. But months later, and it was all over the newspaper, Eli Lilly is clear, they did fine. Nobody even mentioned that there were a couple of jurors who were convinced. Nobody had any idea it was fixed. Even I didn't. I couldn't believe it. Ginger kept telling me it's fixed. I couldn't believe it. And then later on, it turned out it was completely fixed from the beginning, but certainly the judge's opinion in the trial. And the trial verdict was canceled and replaced with the secret settlement. And the Supreme Court of Kentucky raised a question about whether this was fraud and that it was certainly tampering with the judicial system. And then Eli Lilly got the judge to force the judge out, because the judge wanted to know how much money they'd paid when he started to make an inquiry. They forced him out as prejudiced because they'd lied to him. So we lied to him during the trial, so he's prejudiced against us. So we got rid of that judge.
Oh my God.
The next judge who came in didn't disclose the money figures. He said that would hurt Lilly too much, how much they had paid us off with, us being that lawyer that was hiring me. So
Right. That's
the kind of mess. Now, the press never covered any of that.
And no, was anybody at Eli Lilly ever held accountable for that legally? I mean, did anybody go to jail for
No. Nobody was, even as far as I know, censored or slapped on the wrist or anything, except by the Supreme Court of Kentucky, who said some angry words about them. No, know. And the press never covered it. They covered the victory, but not the fraud. So I think that one of the things that I struggle with, you know, I've gone through this progression from when I was young. I was very progressive. I mean, I was reading Karl Marx in the 50s in high school, always looking for what's the next thing. And then I became more of a libertarian and more conservative. But nobody is looking at just how corrupt these companies are. Nobody, you know, Bernie was, and I'm certainly not a Bernie fan because that's just not my politics, but Bernie was looking at it. I think Trump is just beginning to learn that he can't trust any of these people, but it's a hard thing to admit. I think the problem is that human beings were not meant to live in huge corporate kinds of structures where they completely lose their moral connection to the society. And I don't know what to do about that, but that's what I think goes on.
It's interesting that you say that because I don't know if you've read Yohan Hari's book.
No.
Have you? Do you know who he is?
Not really, no.
Well, Yohan Hari, he wrote this book.
What's it called? Do you remember?
I believe it's called, hold on, it's Disconnected or just a second. I had him on the show. He's an amazing guy, but he spent a year. He was terribly depressed, and he wanted to finally kill himself because it had been going on for so many years, and so he decided to spend a year trying to figure out, you know, look, I'm either going to figure out why I have this problem and you know, do something about it, or I'm going to, you know, I'm going to kill myself. And so he went around the world and he said exactly what he found out was exactly what you mentioned, which is we are in myriad ways encouraged to individualize instead of being part, to compete instead of collaborate, to not be communally oriented. And he said it's making us all sick and crazy, you know.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the dissolution of the family is a part of that. I mean, that's the core you start with, is raising kids and being a family community unit, and then the families relate to each other. And I think that's absolutely right. And it's very clear to me that all the corporations that I've had anything to do with, and it's mostly pretty much entirely the pharmaceutical industry, and their connections to the government are entirely corrupt. I mean, what's going on right now with Fauci? I mean, he's corrupt to his drawers, and he's got this lousy drug, Remdesivir, which he personally tried to shepherd through clinical trials, and it's just an awful drug. It's a drug that when it was given to Ebola patients, they had to stop the trial because it was killing the patients. I mean, and that's the drug.
Vaccines are the new moneymaker for...
And vaccines, which he's big on. And
They're calling it now the military pharmaceutical industrial complex. Yes. By the way, Yohan Hari's book is called Lost Connections.
Okay.
And it's exactly what you're talking about. But the thing that has always confounded me, okay, is how you have to have a huge herd of unconscionable people for us to be in this situation where we are now, where you've got 17 veterans per day, military veterans per day are killing themselves. You've got, you know, and we're not talking about the active duty numbers, because they're killing themselves too in record numbers. You've got kids, we have this country is the only country that has really suffered the epidemic of school shooters. And, you know, my friend, and you know her well, Kelly O'Meara, who was a journalist at the time, was the first person in her article, Guns and Doses, for I think Washington Times, Insight Magazine, was the first person to explore the connection between SSRI drugs being given to kids and the school shootings. So, I mean, the history of dangerous and aberrant behavior connected to these drugs and the industry that is fighting to keep, not only just to keep these drugs on the market, but to expand their use.
It's a dreadful, dreadful situation. And again, we're seeing the very same thing going on with COVID-19. I don't know if you mind getting into that a little bit.
No, go ahead. By all means.
I mean, I've been, we were very afraid to get into COVID-19 and all those issues because I feel like my appointed task in life has been to, you know, confront psychiatry, involuntary treatment, shock, lobotomy, the drugs. Confront my colleagues. I am a psychiatrist, so I have a lot of more clout. Well, we began to see what was going on, in particular with hydroxychloroquine, which is, I mean, Goodman and Gilman, which is the biggest, most traditional, old pharmaceutical textbook, called it one, you know, just about the safest drug you can have. And to have these drug companies setting up studies and Fauci aiding and abetting this whole process where the drug looks unsafe because you're actually committing mass murder as a researcher by overdosing your patients so that some of them die. So I got into that. It's in every field, and I didn't want to admit that in the beginning. I thought psychiatry, the problem with psychiatry is it cannot have any scientific basis because none of the things we treat in psychiatry are diseases. And we're using a disease model, a medical model. So you got to fake it. You got to make it a fraud. But do you know, it's so bad that the vaccine companies don't even have to do controlled clinical trials with a placebo?
What do you mean? What do you mean they don't have to go through clinical trials?
They are excused from doing placebo-controlled clinical trials. All they do, and they do it universally, as far as I can tell, is they compare their new drug, their new vaccine, to an older one that's been approved on the market. So if they're both causing encephalitis, well, there's no difference then between the two drugs and the drug gets approved. If they're both causing early death or something, it gets approved because they don't have a placebo control. That control is another seriously dangerous drug. And this is a fact. I never heard this fact until a few months ago when I started to get involved in this. And I've since then, by the way, I've got my first scientific paper coming out on vaccines. And this is one of the points I make. It'd be out in a month or two. It's just awful what the FDA allows drug companies to get away with. And God knows how much money they spent or threats they made in order to accomplish something like that. And as it turns out, a number of the more serious neurological events that take place after vaccines. They're relatively rare, but the vaccines are being given to, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. But some of the really serious neurological events, one of them is called encephalopathy, which is actually just means your brain got real sick from something, very sick from something. They occur within a few weeks. So they'd be picked up in large-scale clinical trials. So it's, but you know.
Well,
if you,
the other thing I think that's unconscionable is this vaccine court, where,
that's
you know,
right.
Basically the drug companies are are given a carte blanche to do whatever harm that they they want to do and not be held accountable ever.
Well, exactly. If you sue for a vet, folks, if you have a horrible reaction to a vaccine, let's say you get encephalitis from the MMR, you can't sue the company. The company's got Congress to absolve them from being sued. Sort of the somewhat similar, but even worse than I think, than the way the, say, an atomic power plant. The atomic power plant said, well, we won't build any plants unless you give us immunity. There can only be a certain amount of suing of us. Well, you can't sue the vaccine companies at all. You have to sue the federal government, who sets aside a certain amount of money to compensate people who it deems to have disorders that may have been caused by the vaccine. And meanwhile,
so insult to injury is your own tax dollars are used instead of the instead of the compensation coming out of the pockets and hurting the companies that created the harmful drug, they are compensated with your own tax dollars.
Well, that's right. And instead of you're suing the company, which you can't do, you're suing the federal government. You got the Department of Justice against you. It's really crazy. And by the way, I wanted to tell you something really exciting that I've been working on for 2.5 weeks, and finally we are on Monday. On Monday, a lawsuit, an injunction, was put into Ohio, where they have a very dictatorial governor, reminds me of the one we have here in New York, and who won't drop his emergency declaration. It's like the emergency's over, the hospitals aren't being flooded with patients, no chance we're going to break the back of the health system like Fauci and other people were predicting. It's just not going to happen in the U.S. And we're handling the cases, and the death rates are going down, and the numbers of deaths are staying very low in the U.S. But the emergency declarations are still being used to suppress American people. I mean, taking away American people's freedoms, and hardly anybody really standing up about it. Well, this injunction is to stop that. And I wrote a very long paper with like 400 citations. Very proud of myself at my age of 84 that I did the darn thing in 2.5 weeks. My wife missed me. The dogs missed me. But
wow.
It's up on my website because the lawyer gave me permission. I did this pro bono. The lawyer gave me permission to put it up and to write a book about it if I want. And it's on my website,
Breggin.com, BREGGIN.com, for anybody who wants to see it, which I want to see it for sure.
It's just got so much information in it, and I set it up so that when you go to the web, if you just scroll down my website, you get past four green boxes, which sort of direct you. Just go a little past them, and you'll see the Coronavirus Resource Center, and you'll see my paper announced, and it's a legal report, but it's broad. It's broad. It's political. It's got a bit of everything in it, but a lot of science about the fakery of this whole epidemic. I mean, the virus exists. People tell me they've actually seen it under a microscope. The virus exists, but it's not the lethal kind of thing that people think it is, and the deaths are being so inflated by the CDC.
Yep.
It's bizarre. I'm glad you're on top of all that stuff too.
Well, I mean, I think that this is, you know, in some weird way, I'm going to say this. I know it's going to sound a little inflammatory, but it's interesting how there's a correlation between 9/11 and this thing. Because after 9/11, it was like, oh, you know, this is these people, these terrorists are so dangerous. We got to control everything. We got to have, you know, pass this Patriot Act. We got to spy on everybody. And now it's like, oh, we have this terrible pandemic. It's going to come back, and we need to control. We need to track people. We need to control people who have been exposed. We got to control everybody that they've been exposed to. So really, we should have this tracking system, and we got to vaccinate everybody. And all of a sudden, now, you know, it's not just controlling like in with 9/11, you know, it was you're treated like a possible terrorist when you go to the, you know, you go fly somewhere, you're treated like, you know, you're surveilled to within an inch of your life. Now they want to get into your bloodstream. Now they want to control what's inside of you. And you're going to control your movements, control. It's weird. It's like another, it's like a tightening of the screws, it feels like.
This is really interesting. Do you know, I actually never put that analogy together, Christina? That's amazing. Now, I think that 9/11 was caused by the people that that we think it is caused by, but then it's grabbed, and that's the same thing with by the globalists and by their oppressors and by the people who want to be shutting down, especially America, because we're the only land that even pretends to believe in individual freedom. I mean, you talk to Europeans. They think individual freedom is a form of assault on other people or something. They have no idea what some of us believe in or why the country was created and what the principles were. But and I don't think that the Chinese released, the COVID-19 purposely, but then they purposely flew all the airplanes all around the world while they were shutting down. So you have these unscrupulous forces that take advantage of any threat. That's how I view it. They don't necessarily create the threat, but they may on certain occasions, obviously. But I don't think they did it on 9/11. I think that was jihadists. But it's so taken advantage of by all the people who want to have top-down government. They want to have authoritarianism. They want to have totalitarianism. And I think what's happening is this is beyond left and right. I mean, it used to be that the globalists were people on the right, but now it's just people on the left a lot of the time. So I think it's just this whole global group. We call it the elite. They don't even necessarily know each other, but they've all built around the modern predatory capitalism, not the free market, predatory capitalism, same as the Chinese. They're capitalists now. They're predatory capitalists. And they've built this global taking advantage of human beings system. I think it's true. I may never have talked about it before on the air like this, but I believe that that is what's going on. And I'm not alone in that, obviously. And I think it's a mistake to see it as a left or right issue. I mean,
that's what I keep telling the few friends I have left in journalism, because you may or may not know, that's my, I blew the whistle on corruption in investigative reporting. And, so I don't have very many friends in the press, but, I'll tell you, on some of these issues, I constantly run into the walls. I'll tell you an interesting story about I had put together, as a matter of fact, you were in my proposal for a series on the school shooters and the connection to the SSRI drugs, okay? And and also looking at the larger issue of drugging children with these SSRIs. And I went, and because I was thinking, well, obviously CBS, the big networks, they're not going to take it. CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, they're not going to take this. I already knew that. But at the time, Vice, you know, the news channel, Vice was touting itself as the brave, we will go where everybody else feared to tread network, right? So went to Vice and pitched this thing, and they loved it. They were like, oh my God, this is amazing. And we had meeting after meeting after meeting. They had little tweaks to the proposal. They wanted this, they wanted that, but nothing that compromised the integrity of the reporting or anything like that, or what was going to be reported and looked into. And like, I don't know how many meetings, 4 or 5 meetings later, we're so excited. We're going to do this. And then they said, okay, we're going to go up to the money people. Next thing you know, silencio. Nobody was getting back to us, you know, whatever. And of course, they killed it. They killed it. And I was so proud of one of the guys who was there at the meetings at all time. I won't mention his name, but he said to me, it was the first honest response I'd ever gotten to, you know, a submission like this. And I've done a few. He said, this was too hot for us to handle. So the press omerta on these issues, I mean, right now with the COVID situation, what the way it seems to work is that there's a constant confusion.
Yeah.
You know, all these reports, this report says there are lots of deaths. This report says there are not a lot of deaths. This report says hydrochloroquine is deadly. This report says, oh no, it's the, you know, next best thing. And they do, and it's done. You can almost, you feel like it's being done, you know, purposely. Okay. So there's a constant confusion, and you can plug into, you can plug into whatever source is akin to your political view.
Right.
And so the truth is just never to be found. It's just lost in this. And I think that's purposeful, you know, and it helps to lead us into, I mean, look at, it helps to lead us into this constant, everybody's fighting each other, because when everybody down below are fighting each other and whatever, again, that invites more control. People are going to say, oh, we got to have more control. We have to have more control on the vaccine and blood issue. We have to have more control on these people, the Antifas against the Black Lives Matter, this and that. It's just continuous chaos, you know?
And I do think that some of that is absolutely so. And Fauci himself creates chaos with changing views and not telling the truth and, you know, talking about how great the drug is and the drug may not work and on and on and on. We're going to have a vaccine. We may not have a vaccine. But I do think that there is a truth stream going on, because I've had people on my radio TV show, my weekly thing that I do, and that there is a consistent theme about things like hydroxychloroquine. There is a consistent theme about Fauci repeating what he apparently did with HIV, of keeping people from getting the best treatments and becoming very powerful and wealthy, at least in terms of running a wealthy institute. So there are some repeated themes, and I myself have read the hydroxychloroquine literature. I got trained to be able to do that by being the single scientist for all the cases against Eli Lilly. I saw things that no one had never even bothered looking at before, and wrote about them in my books and articles, scientific articles. And it is clear that there is a huge push from huge global interests to prolong this shutdown, to shut down hydroxychloroquine, because it is something people could use to not be so afraid, to feel like they were doing something right, and to actually help prevent and help actually cure the early stages of the disease. So that we have a lot of very specific information. The deaths are definitely way below what they're saying, because, you know, just a week ago, you probably heard about this. We got it out on the very quickly, and that is that the CDC, in very tiny print in a very obscure place, admitted that only 6% of their nearly 200,000 deaths, supposedly from coronavirus, only 6% didn't have other causes of death mixed in.
Yeah, it was in the comorbidity section, where
yeah.
they said that most of the people
94% of the people had at least two, average of 2.5 illnesses. Seriously.
Exactly.
It's so crazy.
And you know, it's interesting because the other thing you don't see much of is you don't see coverage of countries where, you know,
where they
have successfully controlled everything. I mean, did you know that Vietnam has no COVID?
I hadn't heard that lately, but I know way back they didn't have any. They used very stringent measures, I think, that we would not necessarily want to use. But, yeah, they have not been overwhelmed at all. And you're saying now that they haven't had any. I believe you, in recent times.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I don't understand why our policy, I do understand, I'm just saying that facetiously,
yeah.
Our policy should follow the Lee Kuan Yew best practices method, I think. Look around the world, see who's, you know, controlling it the most efficiently and the best and what they're using, and use it here. But
yeah.
No, I mean, I think
we've adopted the Chinese method. It's just, I think in part because Trump is in the way, they just can't lock down all the apartment buildings and let people starve inside them like they do in China. But we're following the Chinese model. It's the Chinese virus. We're following the Chinese model. By the way, folks, this is a manufactured virus that, you know, like most viruses, I guess, that comes out of they come out of an animal to begin with, for the labs to get them. And this is a virus that is a bat virus. It's very similar to coronaviruses that we were making, the U.S. was making in collaboration with China until Trump canceled it. I'd like to take a minute and talk about that. And
yes.
And it's even got extraneous molecules on it. It's got what they call a hook that's on HIV that helps it cling to a cell. It doesn't produce the same kind of disease as
that
AIDS.
Makes the human cell receptive to it.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
And it leaked out of the Wuhan Institute. Can I take a minute and tell this story of how I got into all this? This was a shocker. Well, my wife and I had been thinking about for some time, I mentioned earlier, should we get involved in this? And then she sees on Twitter some guy saying, I heard there's a study that the Chinese and the Americans were working on making similar coronaviruses, 2015, and so Ginger goes hunting. She comes up after quite an effort with this article, brings it to me and says, what is this? I said, well, honey, this is like one of the major journals in the world, Nature Medicine out of Great Britain, and this article, and we started reading it together, and she just started using a dictionary, and we started getting into all this. And it turns out that up until about a couple months ago when we blew the whistle on it, the Chinese and the Americans, a big number of people from North Carolina, but there was an FDA person involved. There was also a Swiss person involved and a Harvard person involved, of course, my alma mater. And they were making a virus that was a virulent, purposely making an epidemic coronavirus that had been pulled out of bats, and they were enhancing it. Then they were studying it, and in 2015, one of their main papers, they announced that they had tried very, very hard to make a vaccine for it, and they couldn't do it. I didn't know at the time how important that was, but we learned quickly enough because no one's ever made a vaccine for a coronavirus, or we would be vaccinated for the common cold. So it just no one's ever been able to do it, and there are reasons for it. The virus shifts too often. It doesn't have a controlled center that keeps it very similar so that you can easily do antibodies for it. And reported on this. We sent it to everybody we could find. I talked to people in Europe and so on and so forth. Well, people were, one of the things, and this is about globalism, people were shocked. They had been shocked back in 2015 by this. And questions had been raised with guess who was funding it? Fauci.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you've seen the film Indoctrination, but what they report is, and you have to understand this is very important because the real industry that's being expanded and concurrently with that industry is the vaccine industry, which, as by the way, as Bill Gates says, and Bill Gates is a big figure in this, he said on vaccines, the profit is 20-1. Okay, he was talking about that once. Mm. That's what he said. But anyway, the industry that's being developed is the bioweapons industry. And what happened, apparently, with coronavirus was it was being developed in a U.S. lab, and the NIH raised some questions about the possibility that the work that was being done on this was in contravention of the bioweapons convention.
Yeah, illegal.
Whereupon Fauci immediately farmed it out to China. The research, farmed out the research to China.
I'm not sure that's the exact story. My impression is he simply kept on funding it just like they'd always been doing. It was already farmed out to China. In the 2015 paper, there were two researchers from China who identify themselves as from the Wuhan Institute.
Right. Yes. Yes. That. But
so I'm not sure whether he farmed it out to China.
You're talking about the Lancet article, right? The Lancet piece. It's Lancet, right? The medical journal.
No. This is Nature Medicine.
Oh, Nature Medicine. Okay.
2015.
Because this research has been going on before 2015.
That's right. And it was going on, as far as I know, I think we were the main folks to blow the whistle on this. And we sent it to everybody we knew, anybody we thought might know Trump. And within 2 days, Trump canceled this program. He didn't get any credit for it by the press. Oh, but the thing I wanted to say was, you know, some people were upset that we were making epidemic viruses, but nobody. I talked to a whole bunch of European people on a big network I'm on there, supposedly cutting-edge psychiatrists. None of them thought there was anything wrong with our working with the Chinese on a potential bioweapon. It's like,
well,
globalism has taken over the world.
I'll tell you what. This is the really, really terrifying part about it. Is, you know, if you want, I would consider looking at a pandemic like this as a bioweapon, okay? Because of what it leads to, all right?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, you look at the article and you know they're making bioweapons. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They're describing in that article exactly the effects of this virus, although it is a coronavirus, but it's a...
Now, I'm going to tell you something.
Go ahead.
I think his name is William Patrick. He was the one who developed the anthrax, the trillion spores per gram anthrax that was an inhalable anthrax that was part of the second wave of, you know, the anthrax scare, or the anthrax scare. It wasn't just a scare, the anthrax events that killed people right after 9/11. You know what he said? This is what he said. He said bio warfare is a far better kind of warfare than the warfare that we have now. Because with bioweapons, you can use genetics to target your victims, and you can also, you use it, and while people die, whatever, the infrastructure of the place you are attacking remains, okay, and all the resources remain, and so it's, in other words, he was talking about how this was And it just the hairs on the back of my neck went up when I read this. It was during a Nova interview, and I just thought to myself, this is really scary. It's almost like his prescience, I would say, is terrifying to me.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it, and I think it's even fair to say that once it escaped, China used it as a bioweapon against the rest of the world to level the playing field. And they did it by they themselves denied the virus's existence, denied its tremendous ability to spread, and so on and so forth. They worked with WHO, and they hid the information, but they shut down completely. And all internal travel was shut down in China, but they sent the airplanes with people from Wuhan. They shut Wuhan down, but they sent up the airplanes with all the people to the rest of the world. And Trump, fortunately, shut down travel from China when he realized what was going on. He was excoriated for that. He was called xenophobic and so on and so on. But and nobody, it's again the globalism, nobody in Trump's entire entourage, he said this in public, I haven't heard anybody say, well, no, he said nobody, including Fauci, wanted him to shut down travel from China. And so China, in a sense, they attacked the rest of the world by sending the virus out while they were closing down. I mean,
and let's face it. You have Fauci, you have Bill Gates, you have John Hopkins. They're all jumping on what's going on here. You know, I have an unrelated question. It's very important because it's a question that I have about something completely unrelated. It is about the anthrax. I have 2 minutes here, apparently, but I just want to... You know, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who was the FBI accused him of being the anthrax, guy who
I'm
mailed out.
I'm not going to be able to answer any of your questions. So you're going to know more about anthrax, Christina, than I do. I haven't gotten into that very much.
This isn't about anthrax.
Okay.
It turns out that very questionable whether he did or not. I mean, almost to the point where everybody who knew him said this is ridiculous. He was on Celexa, diazepam,
yeah, heard that,
and Ambien before he killed himself. So yeah. I just wanted you to quickly address what that cocktail could have how it could have affected him to help.
Well, Celexa and you said Xanax and what else?
No, Celexa, diazepam. And Ambien, the sleep aid.
Yeah. Well, you know, just the Celexa, I mean, that's an SSRI. I've looked at the medical records. I've been involved in cases surrounding Columbine and looking at the medical records of, God, I'm blocking on his name, the boy who was older. Oh, my gosh, from Columbine shootings. Everybody knows his name but me right now in the country.
Don't worry.
Excuse me?
No, don't worry about it. Just tell me.
But anyway,
what Celexa does.
He was not crazy until he was put on SSRIs. He wasn't planning to murder mobs of people. He was put on it for some OCD issues, and he became crazier and crazier on it. I've also been involved in cases surrounding the shooter at the Aurora Theater, and he, unlike some others, he was quite violent.
We gotta go. We're being.
All right, I want to have you on my show. I'm gonna call you.
Listen, it was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on. We gotta.
Peter
do
Bregan.
Again.
We haven't mentioned my name in 60 minutes. I'm Peter Bregan.
Bregin.com. If you want to know about this amazing man and his work.
South of the border.